Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, reports from the WISO news team, including news director Emily McCord and reporters Lewis Wallace and Wayne Baker. Up first, the arts organization City Folk will cease to exist by the end of the year, but an agreement between the University of Dayton and City Folk will allow their jazz programming to continue. Today on WISO Weekend, we'll hear from Matt Dunn, president of City Folk, and Paul Benson, dean of UD's College of Arts and Sciences. First, Matt Dunn gives us a little background.
City Folk announced in July that we were suspending our operations and our programming for the foreseeable future, meaning the 2013-14 season and the 2014 festival, as the board looked at its options. One of our options was to look at who could continue to do the type of presenting that we've been known for, knowing that we couldn't continue to present under the business model that we had. So we actually talked to several organizations in the community. We accepted proposals from several, and UD had a proposal that was very much consistent with the type of programming that we have done. So we've been in negotiations with the university. City Folk has an endowment that was established several years ago, specifically for the purpose of presenting jazz. Presently, that's City Folk's only asset, and the board voted unanimously to accept UD's proposal and make them the beneficiary of our funds so that they can continue to do jazz programming, not necessarily under our name, but in the City Folk spirit. UD has agreed to let our legacy live on. They don't currently do a lot of jazz, and this will allow them to do that.
By turning over that endowment, will that essentially then close the doors on City Folk in its entirety?
Yes. Once all the agreements are signed and the transfer happens, City Folk will cease to exist.
And what is the timetable on that?
That will probably happen still in this calendar year.
Any chance UD will take on the City Folk name, or is that not on the table?
That is not on the table presently. One of the points in our agreement is to acknowledge the City Folk Fund at the Dayton Foundation as a source of funding for their jazz programming. But we wanted to be clear to the community that City Folk will no longer exist. And by UD continuing to do our programming, we didn't want to mislead the community by thinking that, oh, well, City Folk is still around. Maybe there'll be a festival. Maybe this concert will happen. Maybe that concert will happen. This will strictly be UD-driven. Although there will be City Folk board members, UD has expressed an interest in setting up an advisory committee to help shape how that funding would get spent, and several City Folk board members have agreed to serve on that initial advisory committee.
I don't know, this has got to be bittersweet for you to know that City Folk's mission with jazz programming will continue, but City Folk will cease to exist.
It is bittersweet. You know, I think that, as I mentioned, our business model was sort of broken, and we couldn't really figure out how to fix that with declining audiences and having a niche market with traditional and folk music. Certainly, we were known for our festival, which traditionally had been free until this year, and presenting bands and artists that you have to pay, nothing is free. And with declining sponsorships and funding, we feel that there are other organizations in town that continue to be presenters, you know, whether it's the Victoria Theater or the Dayton Art Institute or the University of Dayton or some of the local clubs like Jilly's and Canal Street Tavern. There are plenty of places where people can hear music, but the standard that we tried to hold up, we're confident that UD will continue to raise that bar in terms of the quality of musical offerings for the community.
Matt Dunn with City Folk, I appreciate the conversation. Good luck with everything.
Thank you, Jerry. I appreciate the opportunity.
As Matt said, earlier this year, City Folk began looking for a partner organization to take up the mantle on its jazz programs. Paul Benson, dean of UD's College of Arts and Sciences, explains how their interest in the plan became a reality.
You know, City Folk had announced in the summer that they were going to be ceasing operations, and as part of that, they put out a call for institutions, organizations that might be interested in using revenues from City Folk's JazzNet endowment in ways that would be consonant with City Folk's mission. And the university put together a team of people really revolving around our university art series, which is housed in the College of Arts and Sciences, to think about how we might respond to that call. And we submitted a proposal in October that focused on integrating more jazz programming into our art series and reaching out to new audiences in the community in the course of doing that, as well as reaching new audiences on campus. We had long had a partnership with City Folk to support their World Rhythm series, and we also made a commitment to carry on that as world music, I think, is increasingly important to the greater Miami Valley as well as to students on our campus. So we're very, we feel very honored to be able to help City Folk carry on the legacy of culture-building community, even in the formal absence of City Folk as an organization in Dayton.
So City Folk had a number of options, a number of proposals submitted to them. And what was it within UD's structure that allowed for this agreement to move forward? What do you think were the best points that UD could offer?
Well, I think one of the strengths is that we had worked closely with City Folk in the past. Secondly, the team that put our proposal together included the executive director of our Center for International Programs, who was also a City Folk board member, the Fifth Center for Leadership and Community, who had worked closely with City Folk in the past on their Culture Builds Community program, and our art series, which had collaborated on the World Rhythm series with City Folk. So we had many points of connection, and I think each of those points touched on something that was critical to City Folk's mission: more international outreach, more explicit community building activity, and then a strong arts infrastructure. And, you know, one of the things I think is so important about City Folk's legacy is that they always brought top-rate performers to Dayton, and we are intent on continuing that tradition. I personally was a strong supporter of City Folk and really enjoyed the quality and diversity of their programming. And so personally, I feel a strong commitment to really support the constituents that City Folk had and to include them in our thinking about what we might do in the future. But, you know, I have to say that if City Folk had thought we were not a good fit, we certainly would have accepted that. What was most important to us was that City Folk's legacy be continued in a meaningful way.
City Folk says that the agreement will be completed by the calendar year end, and that immediately in 2014, revenue from that JazzNet grant will be available to UD. Mm-hmm. What immediately takes place once this agreement is final?
Right. Well, we've agreed to fund all of the expenses of the March program. And at that time, City Folk will also host an event to recognize their supporters. We will, in the first half of 2014, be forming a community advisory board that will include some board members of City Folk's and some other past constituents of City Folk to help give us input on future jazz programming. Our art series schedule is fixed through May of 2014, so we will begin planning right away with Eileen Carr, the coordinator for our art series, programs for the 2014-15 academic year that incorporate the jazz programming that City Folk will now enable us to fund.
All right. Anything else that we should know about this agreement or what's taking place?
All I'd say is that we found in conversations with Matt Dunn and other City Folk board members a real likeness of mind about how important a diverse range of artistic expression is to the Dayton community. And we're very intent on maintaining that grand tradition that City Folk has here in this region.
Paul Benson is Dean with University of Dayton's College of Arts and Sciences. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning. Coming up next, Politics Ohio.
Welcome to Politics Ohio. I'm Emily McCord. The partisan gridlock in Washington today may have roots in the way we draw congressional districts. That's according to an investigation by the Dayton Daily News earlier this week. Redistricting happens every 10 years, and this is the third straight decade in Ohio that Republicans have led the redistricting process. Gerrymandering, or drawing congressional districts to benefit one political party, is nothing new, but it's gotten easier. These days, technology can pinpoint how people vote and where they live, and it causes these wild-looking districts that have very little to do with geography. I spoke with Ken McCall at the Dayton Daily News, who crunched the numbers for Ohio's 16 congressional districts.
Essentially, what I found was the four Democratic districts held by Democrats out of the 16, were the poorest. They had generally the most minorities and blacks. They had the highest poverty rate, lowest median household income, the highest vacancy rates. Well, three of them had the highest vacancy rates. It had the highest unemployment. So there were a bunch of these. I put together a bunch of these different demographics. And there was a stark differences between the Republican and Democratic congressional districts.
This not only seems then to have an effect on who we elect, but how those elected officials are then leading the country.
Right. There are two basic issues, I think, here. One is the perception of fairness or unfairness in the districts. Because if you add up all the votes for Republican congressional candidates in 2012, and you add up all the Democratic votes for congressional candidates in 2012, that difference was 51% Republican and 47% Democrat. And yet, Republicans got 75% of the districts. So Paul Beck, who is a political science professor emeritus at Ohio State, he said that, you know, that undermines people's confidence in the democratic system because they vote their preferences, but their preferences don't have a chance of winning. So, I mean, there's the fairness issue, and then there's the dysfunction issue. And the fairness issue has been around for a long time. That's, I think everyone has sort of said, well, that's just politics, and that's just politics in Ohio. But it's the dysfunction issue and the problems in Congress that I believe are causing people to say, hey, wait, we've got to do something about this.
And why does that cause dysfunction?
One theory is it causes dysfunction because with all these safe districts, there is not really a swing district in Ohio right now. Whoever wins the primary has the job. And so the general election doesn't really matter. You only have to worry, if you're a candidate in one of these safe districts, you don't have to worry about the other party. You only have to worry about people who are farther either to the right of you if you're a Republican or to the left of you if you're a Democrat. And so the way they feel they have to vote, as these, you know, candidates get pulled farther apart, it creates gridlock and dysfunction in Congress.
Now, gerrymandering, this idea of drawing districts for a political gain of one party over another, I mean, that's been around for a really long time. Why will it change now?
Well, it's beginning to change. It's done by the states. There's no federal law that says how to do this. Around the country, you're seeing states try different schemes. The Ohio Constitution Modernization Commission is looking at a proposal that was first started by John Husted and then it was taken up by Frank LaRose.
Two Republicans.
Senator. Yeah, both of them are Republicans. That would make a bipartisan committee that would draw the maps. So you would need a supermajority of this seven-member commission to get a map approved.
That's Ken McCall with the Dayton Daily News. He says any changes to Ohio's Constitution will have to be approved by that Constitutional Modernization Commission, the Ohio General Assembly, and Ohio voters. For WYSO, I'm Emily McCord.
Thank you. You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks for joining us. There is one segment of the population that has a unique problem over the Christmas holidays. Parents who are incarcerated oftentimes have no way of providing gifts for their children. But as WYSO's Wayne Baker reports, the Salvation Army in Springfield has found a way to make sure inmates can still give presents to their kids.
For the past 10 years, Clark County Jail Chaplain Tony Bailey has been distributing toys to families who have loved ones that are incarcerated over Christmas through a national program called Angel Tree, which is a prison Christian fellowship organization that helps inmates stay connected with their families. Bailey says the jail partnered with the Salvation Army to collect toys for the program, which has grown since it first started in 2003.
We selected probably about a dozen inmates. Each year it grew to now where we're able to do all the inmates with their children.
Bailey goes around the jail to make sure inmates get signed up for the program. He says many of the incarcerated parents are moved to tears after learning their children will receive a gift for Christmas.
There was a girl, and she works in our laundry. She's a trustee, and so she does laundry for the jail along with another young lady. And she burst into tears. She was really bound up about Christmas. She didn't know about the program either. And I told her, don't you worry. I immediately got her application. She's going to be here through Christmas and probably into early part of next year. And just worried sick about her two little kids. She smiles every time she sees me now because she knows she's got things taken care of. So it's very exciting. But when something's done for these folks and they hear about it and they talk to their loved ones and they said, Christmas arrived here. They come and they look at me. While they're in jail, they're looking at me in astonishment. They can't believe it. And so it's something that will leave a seed in them for the rest of their life.
The tough economy has made it difficult for the Salvation Army to keep the inmate program and other toy drives going. Salvation Army Captain Justin Caldwell says Springfield is down about $20,000 from last year, but volunteer efforts have helped keep the programs going.
There's an army behind the Salvation Army, an army of volunteers that make it possible. We've had people just show up and say, how can I help?
Resource manager Chris Grinrod says there were more needy families in Clark County this year and not enough resources to cover all the needs. But he believes Springfielders will find a way to help the Salvation Army overcome its financial problem.
When they see a challenge, they step up. We've seen it in years past, and we do believe that this year will be no exception. We live in a great, generous community.
Toy distribution for the inmate program will be held on Monday, while other needy families have already collected their toys. For WYSO, I'm Wayne Baker reporting.
Sounds, sun comes down. I can hardly see the window. I'm here now. Here now. You'll never know. us ever-changing at midnight. Christmas cheer, Christmas cheer.
You're listening to WISO Weekend on WYSO. Thanks again for joining us this Sunday morning. WISO Curious is a new occasional series that lets our listeners ask questions for WYSO reporters to answer. Our first story, Dave Cheeser of Oakwood heard a story we did about the 6,000 abandoned properties in Dayton.
At the end of the piece, it said that really the one thing that needs to happen is people need to start purchasing the property.
So he wondered, how do you actually do that? Who do you call? Is there a list?
Who really is the person or group that can kind of transform those 6,000 vacant and distressed properties into properties that have a name, price, and location?
To answer all those questions, we sent reporter Lewis Wallace out to meet Dave.
There's a personal story behind Dave Cheesar's question. He's an artist, and he has dreams of opening an artist space with some friends. For the sake of example, I asked Dave to pick out a vacant property he's been eyeing. And we meet in South Park to take a look.
The windows are boarded up, but it looks like it has some big space to it.
It's this solid three-story building with two little storefronts on the bottom floor.
It looks like a lot of potential, so...
So he's interested. To me, it looks cold. There are these big holes near the roof.
So 1420 Wayne.
Yeah, I'm guessing 1420 Wayne.
The next step is call the city of Dayton and ask Dave's question. What do you do if you want to buy up a vacant property?
Planning Community Development. This is John. Can I help you?
John Carter with the city says buyers need to do their homework. Who's the owner? Is it bank-owned? Is it on a demolition list? Is it even for sale?
Every vacant house out there probably has a slightly different story. It could be in a mortgage foreclosure. It could be behind in taxes. It could just be sitting there vacant because the owners are snowbirds and they're in Florida for half the year.
In any case, he says to start on the Montgomery County Auditor's website where there are public tax records for every property. I give that a shot for Dave's dream house.
So now I'm going to go to Montgomery County Auditor, property taxes, search by property address. That's what we want. 1420 Wayne. All right, it's coming up.
The house is owned by Lucy and Thomas Radominski, and they don't owe any taxes. From another internet search, they also don't seem to be selling or renting the place. So why is this three-story house just sitting there? The Radominski's phone number is disconnected, but there's an address listed online. It's in a subdivision north of Dayton.
Hi.
Hi. I'm really sorry to bother you. I'm looking for the Radominskis.
Oh, yeah.
Is this the right residence?
Yeah, Lucy. She's the one that lives here.
The woman who answers the door is Lucy Radominski's caretaker. Lucy's 83 years old.
Lucy's
super charming. She welcomes me into her warm house, and we sit down in her kitchen, and I explain the situation.
I said, just pick one that you find intriguing, and he picked 1420 Wayne.
Oh, that's a familiar address.
But the details are hazy. She recalls there used to be businesses in the storefronts and renters living upstairs, but she doesn't remember why they left.
Why did you end up purchasing it in the first place?
My husband did. I didn't do it. But he's gone, so...
Her adult kids manage the property now. I ask when she and Thomas bought the place.
Oh, I don't remember when, but it's been a long time. It's not too good when you get old like me. Darn it!
This is the story of this one old property. But remember, we're actually talking about 6,000 vacant properties, all with their own stories. Dave Cheesar wants this information to be accessible in one place. In fact, he has a vision, an answer to his own question.
Well, if it were like a magical combination between, like, truly a Zillow and eBay. And
it would connect buyers to owners, city services, property records, make it easy for homes to change hands, for Dayton to rebuild. But right now, that service doesn't exist, and no one's planning to create it. So people like Dave, who want to buy vacant properties, will have to track down those stories one by one. For WYSO, I'm Lewis Wallace.
Are you curious about the Miami Valley, its history, people, or economy? Is there a place, a person, or a story that mystifies or intrigues you? Do you like to ask questions? Help us select our next story for Why So Curious by visiting our website at wyso.org.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the second week of early winter. The deepening of early winter draws down the last pigments of the year past. December spreads across the summer with accumulation of loss. Instinctively and naturally, there is a taking stock of what appears to be no longer present, an inventory of emptiness, cued by a search for the truth and by nostalgia, and by the fragmentary reminders that bind the seasons into memory. Shapes of absent plums and peaches, pears and cherries, broccoli and lettuce, raspberries and blackberries, strawberries and mulberries, and the cotton of cottonwoods. Empty shells of milkweed and hosta, empty canes and branches, seeds eaten, innumerable creatures gone. Faded colors of zinnias and snapdragons and sunflowers and coneflowers, goldenrod and purple ironweed, dahlias and tulips. Vanished fragrances of blossoms from roses and Japanese honeysuckles and azaleas and apple trees and mock orange and lilacs, from alyssum and moonflowers and jasmine. The missing calls of doves and red-winged blackbirds and robins, of toads and frogs, katydids and crickets and cicadas, all of which is fulfilling, not negative, not sad, because it is the very kernel of the known universe, that absence and presence are complementary, that they are two aspects of the same thing, that each is the key to the other, and that we cannot understand them if we view them as separate. From a litany of sensations lost, absences flesh out past events and missing objects. They fill up the present's hollow and deceptive pod. They create wholeness from the part that seems so transitory or broken, but is only incomplete. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the third week of early winter. In the meantime, look for what is gone. It's the other side, the hidden but necessary side of what seems to be present.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at wyso.org.
That's it for this edition of WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at wyso.org. WYSO is a community service of Antioch College for the Miami Valley and beyond. I'm Jerry Kenny. Enjoy your holidays, and we'll see you back here next Sunday morning on WYSO Weekend. Coming up next on WYSO, The Book Nook.
This week on American Roots, the songs of expatriates, beginning with Richard Thompson, the British songmaker known for his distinctive guitar style. He lives in Los Angeles. Also, Cajun singer-songwriter Zachary Richard, who left home to seek the larger French world before returning to Louisiana. I'm Nick Spitzer. Join me for American Roots from PRX.
Coming up this afternoon at 2 on your public radio station, 91.3 WISO.